JSA in the 90s. This episode, a spotlight on Ted Grant, Wildcat. Hello, and welcome to JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. We are a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. My name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, folks, but I am not doing this alone. Thankfully, I have brought along a friend. Well, friend, I guess. More like a longtime associate, really. Or maybe even an acquaintance or an occasional nemesis. Let's just call her a frenemy with tenure. Maybe there's a better way to put it. So today's guest and I, we go way back, like over a decade, to the days where she foolishly invited me onto her podcast as a guest, a move that instantly tanked the integrity of her show and skyrocketed its entertainment value. In addition to being a podcaster, she is a literary enthusiast. She's been a comic book journalist and a presenter at comic book academic conferences, and she's part of our very own Fire and Water Podcast Network, which clearly means she has questionable taste in colleagues. She's brilliant, she's charming, and if you've ever been in a room with her and met her in person, she needs a step stool just to look you in the eye. But make no mistake, her presence is towering. Folks, please help me welcome my friend, Stella. Welcome to the JSA Brownstone, Stella. Thanks for being here. How you doing?
Hey, yeah, you are generous with all those titles that you use, because what you said, I need a step stool, but really what I call you is my stepping stone, because many people know that I'm actually looking to take over several podcasting networks, and when I join the Fire and Water Podcast Network, it was a way to kind of get my foot in the door, and I'm making my way to sort of take over this network very slowly. So thank you for that.
You were just on Fantastic Four recently, so yeah, you're making your way through the rounds.
I am making my way. Yes, no, I am happy to be here. I think that I shocked Shagalicious by requesting to be on the show when it was dropped. I think I just sent a message out of the blue of like, if you do Wildcat, can I be on it? And he said yes. And if there is ever anyone, I think, in the DC universe that can be called a daddy, it is Ted Grant. He is definitely one of my crushes. I don't have a lot of crushes on older characters, but he's the one for me. So I would call him Daddy Grant.
Wow, Daddy Grant. That is wild. That is crazy. is not something I was expecting. Like, I was expecting like, oh, you know, like his integrity or he's a fighter. Nope. He's hot. Apparently.
Okay. He is hot. No, I do appreciate his fighting prowess. And of course he's trained some people I care about a great deal, like Dinah Lance. But I mean, yeah, he's attractive. You don't hold, you know, the license on finding characters attractive. I can also have that.
These folks may not know my reputation. So folks, way back in the day, when I was a less gentle podcaster, I would refer to women as hot all the time, because the fact is they are. Every woman's beautiful in her own way. But I came on Stella's show. She foolishly invited me to talk about Firestorm, thinking we'd just have this nice little conversation. And I went to town, and she was shocked and stunned. And she took quotes of me from the show and created dubstep songs. I'm not kidding here. This is all true. yes, I think I have become a more enlightened person as the podcasting year has gone by. But yeah, you can say he's hot. That's fine.
Yeah, I would demand someone disagree with me and we can have it out for sure.
Oh, he's a handsome dude. He really is. So he's ruggedly handsome. And he's a celebrity too. He's kind of got the whole package.
Yeah. And I like the fact that, I mean, I know we're going to talk about him in depth on this show, but I do like that he feels different to me as a character because he is ground level. And of course you have ground level like Batman, you have ground level like Green Arrow, but just him being a pugilist and being older, but he doesn't look at these young whippersnappers and get resentful of them. I think he uses his own intelligence and his experience to help mentor others, which I think is great because I think there are heroes out there that just like want to be left alone and don't want to help anyone else. So I think he has a lot of admirable qualities and he seems different than some other ground level, no superheroic qualities that we have in the DC universe.
You make a good point about the age too. I think he works better as an elder statesman, actually. Mm-hmm. Like if he was just another young guy, then he's, you know, he's like a Nightwing, but he punches or something, you know, but here being an elder statesman, there's adds a lot to it. That's interesting.
Yeah, huh. For sure.
Well, like Stella said, we're going to talk a lot about Ted Grant here, and because this is one of our spotlight episodes. So far, we've had spotlight episodes on the Holiday Comics, the 1990s. We did one on Jay Garrick, The Flash. We did one on Jim Corrigan, The Spectre, and now it's Ted's turn. So we're going to be talking about his comic appearances throughout the 1990s. Then we're going to do a special focus on two miniseries from the 1990s called Batman Wildcat and then Catwoman Wildcat. They were two miniseries where they were really trying to push him sort of forward into the public eye, and they're a lot of fun to talk about. But first, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of JSA in the 90s is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library, and usually it's tied into this month's JSA issue or topic in some way, shape, or form. I picked one, actually, that's not even out yet. I picked a trade paperback that's about to come out. It's called JSA 2024 Trade Paperback Volume 1, Infinity Inc. versus the Justice Society. So what this does is it collects the first six issues of the current JSA book that's on the shelves. And without getting into any specifics, I will just say it's kind of important, this story, if you're a Ted Grant Wildcat fan, and we will leave it at that. So it is published by DC Comics, written by Jeff Lemire, art by Joey Vasquez and Diego Alorteg. And I probably slaughtered his last name, so I sincerely apologize. He also does the cover art. Page count's 144 pages. Normally it retails for $24.99, but usually there's a 40% discount on in-stock trade. So when it becomes available, it is expected to be released in very early September. It probably will be only $14.99 on in-stock trades, which is a great buy. And again, it's the current JSA series, issues 1 through 6. So Stella, did you happen to bring an in-stock trades pick?
I did happen to bring one. It's a Birds of Prey trade paperback called Fighters by Trade. The writers are Gail Simone and Jim Alexander. There are various cover artists as normal, and Adriana Mello is on there. And art by Joe Bennett, someone we don't like to mention, but it's Eddie Barrows, Jack Jadson, and others. The Birds of Prey face off against mysterious viruses and maybe even find themselves the prey. Huntress goes AWOL, there's a technovirus invading Oracle's body, and Black Canary teams up with Wildcat as they fight for their lives in Singapore. And this is collecting Birds of Prey issues 81 through 91. And it was $24.99, but the in-stock trade price is $14.99. So we are saving 40%. And I just covered these on Backworld Oracle. So if you got it, you'd be practically caught up to me.
There we go. And you should be listening to Backworld Oracle, a Barbara Gordon podcast.
I appreciate that. Yes. Thank
you. It's a great show. And let's face it, we all love Barbara Gordon, right? Whether it's Batgirl, Oracle, whatever. It's a fantastic show, Stella. And you've been at it for 15 years now,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. It's a teenager now.
Wow. So I have to ask a dumb question because I'm not current on stuff. When you say this is Birds of Prey 81 to 91, that's the original volume one, right? Like the pre-New 52 stuff. Is that right?
Or is pre-New 52. Okay. I think technically it's not volume one because they had those miniseries that Chuck Dixon was doing. So this might be like volume three, but this is pre-New 52.
Okay.
Pre-Brightest Day when they restarted, I think, the thing. Yeah.
Gotcha. Because I mean, these stories sound very familiar. I'm like, I'm pretty sure I read these, but.
You probably have. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, if it was that era, I did. Absolutely. Well, folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Fire & Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. I mean, just hosting Stella's show alone takes up an insane amount of bandwidth. So a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JSA in the 90s podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And in certain tiers, you get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. So our thanks to this all-star squadron of supporters. Thank you to Alex Osias, Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, Chris Mort, David A. Scudieres, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Ducky, Extremely Uncanny, Gord Tolton, Jason Keane, Jay Campbell, John Coos, Keechee Baker.
Ooh.
little Keechee Baker? Grunkle?
Grunkle, yeah.
I don't think anyone has ever booed during the Patreon support section. It kind of goes against the whole idea of thanking the supporters, but that's great. All right. So Little Keechee Baker, then Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Matt Ev, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Zumkowski, Roger Preeb, Little Russell Burbage, Sean Ross, Symbol Pending, Ted Kilvington, Tim Price, and our newest Patreon supporter for the JSA in the 90s podcast, Craig Fletcher. Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. So folks, remember, go out on the social media. You can find us as JSA Presents and get involved. Share your thoughts with us because it's all about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. And if you want your comments right on the air, be sure to leave those on our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com. Now, this is the part of the show where I get to talk to Stella about her love for this daddy of a character. I want to know, what's your personal origin with Wildcat? Like, how did you find the character? And maybe we've already leaned in a little bit, but like, what do you enjoy reading about the character?
Yeah, so my first introduction with him was the Justice League Unlimited animated series, and specifically the episode The Cat and the Canary, where you actually see Dinah and Ted gets, you know, a big spotlight for that. And I just thought, number one, I like his suit. Shag and I were talking off air. There are certain aspects, depending on the artist, of things that I don't like about his, like, headgear. But overall, like, I just think it's really cool looking. And again, yeah, his fighter, the fact that his hands are like taped on the outside, I just think he's really cool. That he's a trainer, like I said, I think that mentor aspect is something that I really appreciate. I think that's coming from Barbara Gordon being a mentor to Stephanie Brown and Cassandra Cain, and being an educator in real life. For me, mentoring youth and young adults is really important to me. And so I think I feel a kindred spirit in that way as well. And I feel like he's an amazing fighter. I think fighting wise, I might put him maybe in the top 10 of the DCU. If we were to just go with like bare knuckle and not do any martial arts, because I think you have to be very specific because there are some people he wouldn't be able to take, I think. But yeah, again, I just like what he's doing, his mentoring aspects, his abilities. The look is cool. He's an attractive older gentleman. And he's kind of a gruff guy. You know, he's kind of a grumpy person. So perhaps if there were a romance novel written about me and Ted Grant, he'd be grumpy and I'd be sunshine. It'd be lovely. coming to a Neurotica store near you. So those are the basic reasons, I think, that I really like. And that was a really amazing episode. I actually should have rewatched that before I came on here, but I just remember that being a great episode of someone that I had no idea who that was, and then just kind of fell in love with that character.
So I'm really glad you mentioned that Justice League Unlimited episode of The Cat and the Canary. If I'm remembering right, is that the one where Ted is in the meta brawl, the roulette meta brawl thing?
It is, yes.
And how fitting is that, right? Because, I mean, the story we're talking about today is very similar. There's a lot of air parallels, though. And what a great episode to meet the character on. I mean, it's a fun episode. I love all this stuff with Black Canary. I love how he was portrayed in that episode. So that's awesome. And as far as his mentorship that you mentioned, I mean, who hasn't he mentored at this point in the DC universe? I mean, we know he's mentored Bruce Wayne. We know he's mentored Black Canary. I guess we find out here he mentored Catwoman. And it just seems like the list goes on and on. And then you mentioning that, you know, he's a handsome older gentleman, which I totally can relate to, right? I mean, I totally understand that, being one myself as well.
I see.
So for me, how I met Wildcat, thanks for asking, it was probably during Crisis on Infinite Earths, you know, and he didn't have a huge role in there other than his legs get broken, right? Which is kind of like,
oh my
wow.
Gosh.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was a setup. They broke his legs and said he'd never walk again, or at least never be able to fight again or whatever, and so that they could introduce Yolanda Montez as the new Wildcat. So that was an intentional step they took. But either way, probably Crisis where I first saw him. Then probably diving in the 50 cent bins, I picked up those 1970s All-Star comics. And I adore those 1970s All-Star comics with the JSA revival. And he's just fussing and arguing with Power Girl the whole time. And it's this fun banter they have. And it's really enjoyable. Then I would have gone to All-Star Squadron. And then the JSA in the 90s comics by then, which were on the shelves. So I was absolutely in love with them. And in addition to the things you mentioned, like the mentorship and all that, one of the things I loved about the character was back in the day, he was just Earth 2, meaning there was not an Earth 1 counterpart for Wildcat. And I always kind of like that. There weren't a whole bunch of unique superheroes that were unique to their world. And I like that aspect about him. Now, before you nerds start writing in the comment section, and I'm sure some of you have already started, yes, I am well aware, there's this whole theory, there was an Earth One version of Wildcat to explain the Bob Haney, Zany Haney stories. Come on, guys, that's not a thing, okay? So let's not get hung up on that. Also, I love the pugilist aspect that you mentioned, right? I mean, he's not only a fighter and a bruiser like most other superheroes, he's got the skill, he is a performer, he's a celebrity. I mean, all those things, he doesn't just know how to punch someone, he knows the skill that you should use in a fight to be effective. And he doesn't have any powers. I love that about him. So the whole aging celebrity bruiser ladies man thing, it really works well. And yeah, adore the character, and I'm so excited to be talking about him. All right, so I'll tell you a little bit about his history. So I didn't know this off the top of my head. I actually had to do a little bit of research, so it's sort of interesting. He was created in 1942 by writer Bill Finger and artist Irwin Hazen, I think that's right, and he debuted in Sensation Comics number 1. So the story basically works, back in the 1940s, Ted Grant was a world-class heavyweight boxer who was framed for the murder of a fellow boxer and a guy that was also his friend, and it was all set up by these mobsters who were trying to cover their own actions. And here, Ted, on the run, he was inspired by masked men of the era, like Green Lantern, so Ted dons a cat-like costume to fight crime and clear his name. Obviously, he succeeded. He goes on to continue to be Wildcat. He has no powers, only his boxing skills and street smarts, and he uses his fists and his grit. With those, he built a legend. Absolutely love the character. So now we're going to talk about him in the 1990s. This is going to be a lot of an info dump, folks. So I'm going to rapid fire go through a whole bunch of his appearances in the 1990s. I'll mention them briefly and then just keep kind of rolling along and mention why they may or may not have been important. Now, keep in mind, as we begin the 1990s, again, I mentioned that crisis thing, right, where his legs were broken, because Wildcat at that point has a new protege, Yolanda Montez. She's taken over the mantle of Wildcat. Also, at this point in 1990 when we start, Ted Grant, as Wildcat, is stuck, along with most of the other JSA members, in another dimension. He's seemingly forever fighting this battle of Ragnarok. So he's not even around in present-day DC when we begin the decade. And again, there's probably going to be books in here that I missed. This is not all-inclusive, so please feel free to include other guest appearances in the comments section. So here we go. Secret Origins number 50 from August 1990. That was a multi-book. It had a bunch of stories in it, but one of them was the Black Canary origin of the modern age Black Canary, if you will, Dinah Lance. And it was written by Alan Brennert with art by Joe Staten and Dick Giordano. In that story, there is a small part where we see Ted Grant. Again, it's a flashback. He is training young Dinah how to fight. And that's, as we said, that's part of the way Black Canary learns to fight, and that I would say that carries through into Birds of Prey, doesn't it?
Yeah, 100%.
Then we jump forward to 1992, a couple years, to Armageddon Inferno, the beloved Armageddon Inferno miniseries that almost only like one person in the world really likes. But anyway, the reason this story is important is that the JSA in the story return from that limbo dimension to modern day. So they've been off the table for 6 years in DC publishing history. Now they're returning to modern day. And honestly, Wildcat's he's mostly a minor supporting character. Right? So it's not even worth getting into the details of it, but it's really important simply because it returns Ted to present day, which is great. Then jumping forward a little further, we get to the Justice Society of America series, which we've been covering on this very podcast, right? The 10 issues, 1992 to 1993. It's a fantastic spotlight for Wildcat. We've been talking about him all through the series, and we got a couple more issues to go. We'll keep talking about Ted. Love, love, love him in that series. Absolutely phenomenal. Then, and this is sort of interesting, the same time Justice Society of America is wrapping up that series, he also appeared in Justice League Europe. From February to May 1993, there was a storyline called Red Winter in Justice League Europe, where the Justice League are fighting a bad guy named Sonar, and the JSA guest stars in the issue, which is really cool because the art is actually by Mike Parabek, the guy who's drawing the regular monthly Justice Society series. So they actually got Parabek to come over, draw some pages for the Justice League Europe book, which is great. Now again, Wildcat's mostly a minor supporting character, not terribly worth mentioning a lot, and quite frankly, that's the Justice League Europe era that is not great and not being written by an amazing writer. So we'll just say he's in there, and it's worth looking at because they're drawn by Mike Parabek. So it's worth taking a look at those.
Look at how big he is compared to the other men on that same row. He's the biggest person compared to who's that red furry person?
That's Tasmanian Devil.
Oh, okay. He's the second largest person.
Yep.
That's nuts.
Parabek draws him as big, if not bigger, than General Glory. So he's a big dude. It's great. I love Parabek's art. It's so good. It's so fun to see other Parabek art outside of the Justice Society series we cover each month. So it's just nice. All right, then going on, now Ted's not in this issue I'm going to mention, but it's worth mentioning. So shortly, about, I don't know, 6 to 8 months after that Justice League Europe appearance, Eclipso number 13 is published. This is an infamous issue because what happens in this issue is a whole bunch of characters go down to fight Eclipso and they all get murdered. And it was a terrible story where DC just kind of wiped a whole bunch of characters out. And sadly, Yolanda Montez was one of the ones who was murdered by Eclipso in that story. So at this point, Yolanda has passed away.
Yolanda Montez, was she liked by fandom at the time?
Well, I don't think anyone necessarily was against her, but she just wasn't being published is what happened. So okay. There was the Infinity Inc. book that was out in the 80s. And so like from 1985 with Crisis to whenever Infinity Inc. ended, like, I don't know, 1988, 1989, I think that's off the top of my head. She was an active character. But once that series ended, no one picked her up and used her. So I don't know that she was necessarily disliked. But at this point, DC saw they had a whole, what they felt like was a bunch of extraneous characters. Like here, Ted Grant's back in modern day. So now you've got two Wildcats running around. You know, is that needed? It killed her. Sadly, they also killed Beth Chapel, the second Dr. Midnight, because once again, the original Dr. Midnight was back in continuity. So they felt like maybe they were extraneous. I mean, they wiped out a bunch of people in this Eclipso story. And most of them, I don't know if it's most of them, but many of them have found their way back. Like Yolanda's alive again. Let's just put it that way. So because comics, and thankfully because of Stargirl, really. Stargirl helped elevate her popularity, her and Beth both. So that leads us from that death of Yolanda Montez leads us about 8 months later to Showcase 94, issue number 8. So if you don't remember Showcase, these books Showcase, what they would do is they do like 3 or 4 short stories in each issue. And so in Showcase 94, issue number 8, they did a Wildcat short story. And the story is basically someone is trying to resurrect Yolanda Montez because, again, she's been passed away. And it turns out really it's just a shyster trying to fool Yolanda's parents into giving them a bunch of money is ultimately what it is. Ted gets involved. And Ted uncovers the scheme, but there's some nice emotional beats where it shows Ted mourning Yolanda's loss. It really gives us the chance to see Ted's reaction to her death, which we didn't get to see at any point in any other comics. So it's at the very least, it's nice to remember Yolanda and spend some time sort of honoring her in that story.
May I say something?
No.
In no way, I'm just ignoring you. In no way would someone for the representative photo of the deceased at the funeral use a beach photo with a person in a bikini.
Right, exactly. Yes. The pages I pasted here, you didn't see all the pages. Ted himself takes that picture of her. Like she's asking him to. I think it's like a modeling photo or so. I don't remember the details. But yeah, you're right. At the funeral, they're not going to put a picture of her in a bikini on the on the coffin. Absolutely not. It was the 90s is the best thing we can say, folks.
Okay.
And the art is very 90s so as well. Then we jump forward to September 94 with Zero Hour, which was a major event, which if you're a JSA fan, it's pretty painful. They really just took like a scythe and swathed right through the JSA in this story. Basically, Extant wipes out a bunch of the JSA and he uses his time manipulation powers. He basically ages Wildcat to his true age, which is about 80 years old. It's sad to see. At the end of it, Wildcat is like a withered old man, and the doctor says he's going to live, but in fact, he lives, but Dr. Midnight, they couldn't save, sadly. So it's interesting because there he's 80 years old, but then you jump forward just, 2 years to Guy Gardner, and he's still supposed to be an old man, but he's a lot more spry. I would say he comes across as like late 50s, I think is more where he sort of lived, or maybe early 60s. I don't know. It'd have to be a really healthy early 60s. I'm thinking late 50s, but you get to Guy Gardner Warrior, and he's in a whole bunch of issues there. I'm not going to rattle them all off, but starting with issue 29 and then several after that, basically from March 95 to May 96, he becomes a supporting character in the Guy Gardner book. He's not around a lot, but when he appears, and he's like again, at Guy Gardner 29, he's there for the grand opening of the Warrior's Bar. And so he just kind of becomes a hanger-on. He hangs out with Guy. He hangs out with Buck, which is another supporting character. He's just kind of a fixture at the bar. And we've got a couple pages here where Zinda, who is Lady Blackhawk, shows up. She's been hurtled from the past, from the 1940s, all the way to modern day of 1996 or 95. And she comes into Guy Gardner's Warriors because she met Guy in a time travel adventure. And her and Wildcat kind of have a spark there. What do you think of that?
I'd be okay with that. I wish that had happened in Birds of Prey. I didn't see any of that go on, but that's lovely. I will admit that I've been a bit critical on my show of Zinda, her character, just because she doesn't really seem to be doing much except piloting. But yeah, it'd be interesting to read this so that I could get more of a sense. And yeah, look at that.
Well, Zazenda became a supporting character in the Guy Gardner book, too. Now, I don't know if she got a lot to do either. I do feel pretty confident that her and Wildcat do hook up, though. There's definitely a will they, won't they, but then I think there's a, oh, they did, I think as well, as if I recall correctly.
Do you think it passes the creep test, though? Do you know what the creep test is?
No, I don't know. I know what the Bechdel test is. I don't know what the creep test is.
It has nothing to do with that. It's your age divided by 2 plus 7. And that's like if you're dating that person and they fit in there, then it's okay. But if they're below that age, then it's probably not okay.
No, okay. I had not heard it as the creep test. I'd heard it as, can I go out with her? Test. So
if you have to ask, maybe right, not.
If you got to get out the calculator, maybe you shouldn't. But now it all depends on how you define this, right? Zinda's probably 25, you know, chronologically, but she's also probably born in the 1920s. So,
that's true.
You know, how do you measure her age? Do you measure it by her life experience or do you measure by when the calendars are? Yes, he's probably way too old for her. However, you just said yourself, he could be your zaddy. So
that's true.
I think he gets a pass because he's just so damn charming.
There you go. I'm sure that's what everyone thought about. Was it Kyle Rayner or was it Hal Jordan? And that
Hal Jordan. That was a whole different thing. She was 14 years old. That was
I'm sure
up.
He gets a pass too.
Nope. Hal Jordan gets zero pass in my book for that. Anyway. Now the hate mail is going to come in. Thank you. So you are just a dangerous guest to have on a show, I tell you. All right, then we fast forward to 1996, to July, and we go to Robin, issue number 31. So this is an issue of the Tim Drake Robin. It is written by Chuck Dixon with art by Mike Waringo, where it's a fun little adventure where Wildcat and Tim Drake team up. I didn't remember this. I read it because I have every issue of this Robin run, and I must have adored it back then, but I had forgotten until I did my research, and it's kind of fun. I mean, Tim holds his own. Tim figures out the Wildcat, Ted Grant sort of quote-unquote mystery, so it was kind of fun to see. Now, you didn't read this Robin series, did you?
I've read pieces of it, but this might have been before I started, because I definitely was reading it if there were interactions with Stephanie Brown and then Cassandra, and I would read it whenever he was crossing over in some of the big Batman events. But I'm not surprised he figured out the mission, because if he couldn't figure out who Wildcat was but figured out who Batman was, that would be, I think, a major issue.
That's a good point. So I think you had some comments on the artwork here of Michael Ringo's version of Wildcat.
You're like throwing me under the bus after the Hal Jordan business. But I just don't see. I said that I have very particular preferences when it comes to his mask or his headgear. And this, I've seen some like jowls, I guess, is the only thing I could explain, where like the material goes down below his jaw, but it's almost as if it were like the bottom part of a Roman centurion's helmet. And here it's like fur or hair. And I'm like, I just think it's unnecessary.
Well, you know, his costume's supposed to be furry. Like, there's supposed to be a very small layer of fur on his entire costume.
Wow.
Like, if you look at his elbows, you can see there's a little bit of the fur sticking out there. Yeah, the whole costume's supposed to be fur. So it's got to be hotter than hell in that thing,
I'm telling you, this erotica is writing itself.
Forget the velvet glove. We've got Wildcat's costume.
I know, seriously.
Oh my gosh. So yeah, he basically drew, like, you know, Wildcat has longer, shaggier cat hair that comes like maybe from the jaw down is what it is. So, and Waringo being, he really had a hyper cartoonized style, which I adore. But yeah, he really accentuated it there, and it does look a little unusual, but yeah, but then you see Wildcat jumping from bridges and stuff. It's so good. It's so good. So love it. Then later that year, he appears in Final Night, which was a big crossover where the sun is going out. In fact, if you want to listen to one of the best episodes of Batgirl to Oracle, a Barbara Gordon podcast, listen to the one about Final Night, because the guest star on that episode, that's a handsome dude right there. So it's worth listening to. So, and really, in Final Night, Wildcat is mostly just cameos. I mean, he barely appears. He barely has a speaking part at all. But the only thing that's worth mentioning is there is one moment where Wildcat's hurt very badly. We don't even see the fight. Just chapter 3 opens with Guy Gardner slamming open the door with a Feral Lad, and he's carrying Wildcat, and he's yelling, "Medic!" And they're saying that Wildcat has really been injured very badly. So,
oh, you can see the fur.
Yep. Yes, you can. That would be thanks to Stuart Immonen, which is a fantastic penciler. That's why. Yeah. Yeah. So as you said, it's writing itself. Then we fast forward to December 1996. So Wildcat was getting quite a bit of love in the mid-90s. I mean, he really was making a lot of appearances here. And this is where they start to try and make Wildcat a thing. So again, Showcase. Now, before Showcase 94, now Showcase 96, because they change the name every year. In issue 11, Wildcat got a short story. And basically, they retold Wildcat's origin. And this is just 4 months before the Batman Wildcat miniseries. And one of the co-writers on this short story is also one of the co-writers on the Batman Wildcat story. So I get the feeling like this was intentionally scheduled, trying to queue up that upcoming miniseries so people see Wildcat's origin again. They kind of get refreshed on it and they're getting ready for something like that. So this one was co-written by Beau Smith, and it's a good retelling of his origin. It's pretty straightforward. There's not a lot of retconny type stuff in here as far as I could tell. And it makes for a good recap. And there he's got the really long jowls on that one. Yep. So then we get our miniseries we're going to be talking about today. Batman Wildcat issues 1-3 in 1997 and Catwoman Wildcat 1-4 in 1998. We'll get back to those in just a minute. So that's where he really gets his biggest moment to shine in the 90s. Then at the very end of the 90s, and we're not going to spend really much time talking about this for a reason. JLA, this is the Grant Morrison era, issue 28-31. This is the story called Crisis Times 5. This is where the JSA and the JLA team up. It's a great story, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time discussing it here because we will discuss this story when we change this show from JSA in the 90s to JSA in the 2000s, which is coming, within the next year or two. So that will be discussed then. But the thing that's worth noting here is Grant Morrison revealed in that issue that Ted actually does possess a superpower. He has 9 lives. And apparently this is due to Zatara apparently altering some curse that was intended to transform him into a cat a long time ago. So now, is that still in effect? Who knows? And was he kidding? He could have been kidding. I don't know. But there's something to be said for a fun idea for him having 9 lives. I love that. And then, of course, the 90s wraps up with the new JSA series, which he is a continuing character in. And again, that all is going to get covered in JSA in the 2000s. So there we go. That is a sort of rapid-fire look at his appearances throughout the 90s. But we now are going to get into these two miniseries. And if you want to see some pictures, some images from these comics, not a lot of them, but just a few, you can go out to fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can look at the image gallery for this episode. There will be a few pages and covers from this these miniseries. Now, if you want, this thing is easily available digitally. It's on the DC Infinite app. In fact, it's pretty cool. I have the DC Infinite Ultra. And not only can you read the miniseries, you could actually read the collected edition out there as well, which is a really slick collection. It's actually got, check this out, it's got both Batman Wildcat, and it's got Catwoman Wildcat, plus it's got 5 other old Brave and the Bold team-ups featuring Wildcat teaming up with Batman from like 1970 to 1976. So that's actually what I'm using today as we chat, is I'm looking at the Omnibus or Collected Edition from 2018. So it's pretty cool. All right, so here we go. Round one, ding ding! Batman Wildcat, it's a 3-issue miniseries, cover dated April through June 1997. It was on the shelves February through April 1997. Cover price was $2.25 per issue. There were 3 different covers. The artists vary on each one of these. So it's the first issue is Tony Daniel and Art T. Bear. The second issue is Art T. Bear and Jamie Mendoza. The third issue is Art T. Bear and Danny Mickey. So Stella, why don't you tell me about the covers? Either tell me about all of them, one of them, I don't care. How do you want to do this?
Yeah, I mean, I can talk about all of them if you would like. I feel like they are all pretty successful, with maybe the first and the third being the strongest. And I think that the third being my favorite in particular.
Okay.
For issue number one, we've got this, the paper pain event of the year, which I think works out. Is pay-per-view even around anymore? But that was definitely like a 90s,
oh yeah,
early 2000s thing. You have Batman that's kind of looming over everything. And then you have Wildcat, which you come to find it's not actually him, fighting Killer Croc, which, and very dynamic, and you've got bats in the background and movement with the characters. I think that is great. And then it shifts a little bit, and you put Wildcat in the background for the second one, The Sweet Science Turns Sour, and you have Batman versus, I don't know who that is,
Eddie Chubb.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, I think it's good. Again, there's motion involved. That one's probably my least favorite, but my favorite one is this third one. No Other Words really are necessary. You've got the Batman versus Wildcat, and you have them both in the background and the foreground, highlighting the cestus gloves that they have. And you've got basically what would look like, I think, if you had a primetime fight, you know, that was going to be marketed on HBO, how the two would look at each other, which is their floating heads, and then them actually in motion on the bottom with it seemingly the stage crumbling. So I think that one's my favorite.
You know, you kind of sold me on the third one. I've liked it, but it wasn't my favorite. But it really is. It is the one they used on the cover of the trade paperback, by the way. So you're not alone. Now that you describe, because I was just thinking, why are we seeing them twice? But once you describe the back, the surprint, if you will, version in the back, It's not quite surprint, but still, the monochromatic version in the back is sort of, like you said, the prize poster, right? It's the poster for the fight. And then you're seeing them in motion fighting. And then you had some fancy word to describe their gloves. Their gloves are spikes.
Cestus. Yeah, the cestus gloves go back to ancient Roman times where, they'd be weighted gloves. They would sometimes have spikes on them. So, yeah, definitely. It goes to my Latinist classicist heart.
Oh, they're a nasty piece of work. So it is a great cover. And my personal favorite is well, maybe I'm coming around to number three now. I don't know. My personal favorite was number one. I love the big looming Batman whose skin is even looks a little blue like the moon. Mm. It's kind of creepy. And then but when you look at Wildcat and Killer Croc, they look so 90s. It's ridiculous. So maybe I'm coming around. I don't know. One and three are great. So we'll just leave it at that. Then since we're talking about covers, let's go ahead and talk about the Catwoman and Wildcat covers at the same time. That's a 4-issue miniseries. Came out a year later. Was cover dated August through November 1998. It was on the shelves June through September 98. All four covers were by Brian Stelfreeze. So clearly DC was spending some money here. They're like, okay, we're getting a big name because he was a big comic cover guy at this point. The Shadow of the Bat and all that stuff. Cover price was $2.50 per issue. So we had a 25-cent increase since last year. Curse you, DC, and inflation. So how you want to cover these?
I can talk about all of them again. I will give Stelfreeze the main positive I will say about it is they are all beautiful. I've got like some, I think, thematic issues with them. And I feel like he does not over-sexualize Selena, which is completely different than what we see inside the pages. With issue number one, I'm not sure where he got that particular sword. I don't recall seeing a sword, but it's the typical headache of a mandatory, for some reason, yet unnecessary fight between heroes, which I felt like that occurred in issue two, actually. But you see them kind of dancing in midair amidst all the lights of Las Vegas.
Oh, wait, I just realized something. We're actually looking them upside down. If you look at the top corner by the DC bullet, you can see that building's upside down. So they're over the skies of Las Vegas, and they're actually probably in free fall at this point as they battle, which is sort of interesting, upside down. Okay.
Where he got his sword. I'm still focused on that.
Right.
number two, I think I feel like it's the most interesting, but I have, I think, moral and ethical issues with these two hooking up, which we'll talk about once we go together. We can have that discussion.
Okay.
But yeah, you've got it seemingly from a, what are those called? A photo booth.
Yep.
Kind of the last two, you can see them, the final one they're kissing, and you have all the stereotypical things that you would see if you were in a casino with pearls, a string of pearls and some chips and a deck of cards and some dye and a glass of whiskey, maybe. That is not neat because it has Ice Cube in it.
That is correct. And it looks like it's sitting on maybe a craps table or something, perhaps.
Yeah. Why don't you do the next two?
I'll go through these quickly. These are not a little less impressive. They're fighting an issue three. It's a big yellow background, and they're fighting one of the big bads, a guy named Clawhammer, who is this giant gorilla of a guy. And here, Wildcat is beneath him and punching it, like up, doing an uppercut into his face. And Catwoman is actually standing on Clawhammer's back and smashing a bottle of champagne over his head, which is kind of interesting. And it looks like Clawhammer's really taking the consequences there. Then issue four is another upside down cover where we see a ton of people people. It looks like a crowd, maybe running or panicking. Some of them have guns. Maybe it's a giant melee, but they all have the same colored suit and same colored hair. It's a little weird. And then hanging above them is Wildcat and Catwoman, both dangling by ropes, almost like they would at a circus. But the view, what makes the cover interesting is the view has been flipped. So all this crowd of people are actually upside down, and we're looking at Wildcat and Catwoman almost as if they're right side up, except they're upside down. They're dangling. So like this cover would make more sense for me to like a Nightwing and a Batgirl kind of thing. Not so much Catwoman and Wildcat. So you've already sort of leaned into it. I'll just say it. Their covers are beautiful, but they don't do much for me, except for number two. I actually like number two a lot. If you remove the potential ickiness of the relationship and just acknowledge that it does happen, so it is part of the comic. So yeah, the three image photo booth, like the top one, they're sticking out their tongues. The next one, they're just kind of looking. And the third one, they're smooching. And then I love all the casino iconography, like all the stuff you described. I love that one. I think that's a great cover, issue number two. That's my take on it.
Absolutely, yeah. The four, it's just confusing with the details that are there because I want to read more into it. Like their bodies are making an X. Are we supposed to see like, oh, there's a lot of death, which there is a lot of death in that particular issue. And then the way that he has the rope wrapped around a wrist, is that talking about when he was actually like tied up? Or I guess he was like handcuffed to that table of torture. But yeah, I don't know. Why are there all those clones? So I just have many questions about that one. But I agree that I think two is probably the best one.
And I would say only two and three are really representative of what happens in the comics anyway. So
yes.
All right. Well, let's get inside here. So what we're going to do is I'm going to read a recap for both miniseries. And then we're just going to kind of have a free-flowing discussion touching on different points throughout. So for both series, the creator credits are actually stay very similar across both miniseries. So the writer on both of them is the combination of Chuck Dixon and Bo Smith, both powerhouse writers in the 90s. The penciler on both miniseries is Sergio Cariello, and the editor on both miniseries is Eddie Braganza. Now, there are some variations as you get into it, though, on the other roles. Like, for example, the inker on the Batman Wildcat, the inkers are R.T. Bear and Danny Mickey. On the Catwoman Wildcat, the inker there is Tom Palmer, though I would have never guessed that in a million years because I've read a lot of Tom Palmer stuff. I'm not seeing Tom Palmer there. Then the colorists also changed. The Batman Wildcat colorist is Jason Wright, and the Catwoman Wildcat colorist is Pat Garay and Jason Wright. So here we go. Back to, again, round one. Ding, ding. Batman Wildcat from 1997. Here's our recap. So Ted Grant, our beloved and grizzled pugilist turned Wildcat, gets wind of an underground fight club called the Secret Ring after Hector Ramirez, who's a rising boxer and a Wildcat fanboy, is murdered by Killer Croc. Turns out Hector had taken up the Wildcat mantle without Ted's blessing. Enraged, Ted tears through Gotham, hunting for answers about the fighting ring where Hector Ramirez was killed. Meanwhile, Bruce Wayne hears about the ring from his golfing rival, Devlin, who's a pampered one percenter who watches the brutal bouts on recordings of the pay-per-view illegal broadcasts. Bruce suits up as Matches Malone to investigate. Then deep in the Gotham sewers, there's a washed-up boxer and certified maniac named Ernie Chubb, who runs the secret ring with the help from a man named Lockup, who's essentially a poor man's master jailer. Now, Lockup is obsessed with vigilante justice, and he's built this nightmare of a dungeon for supercriminals called the Sewer of Life. Sounds very cozy, right? Between Ernie Chubb, Lockup, and the Secret Ring, just think about the JSA's foe Roulette, or the one we mentioned from the JLU cartoon, right? But this is 5 years before Geoff Johns created her. Chubb organizes his next match, right, with twisted tech and razor wire and steroids and satellite fields and all this stuff. You know, what we find out about Ernie Chubb is that he was booted from pro boxing for being too lethal. Now he wants his revenge and subscribers. This guy is like the dark web YouTube before there was one. Wildcat finds an informant and quote-unquote questions him, that'd be putting it mildly, until he spills the beans on the ring's location. Meanwhile, Oracle helps Batman zero in on it too. So neither hero knows that the other's involved. Both are captured, and Chubb decides to make them fight each other. So they're blindfolded, wearing these spiked gloves that are called what?
Cestus gloves.
There we go. Thank you. Thank you for bringing the level of education up in this episode.
You're quite welcome.
So wearing these gloves, Batman and Wildcat, and they're blindfolded too, and they're tossed into the the ring. They're trading blows. They don't know who they're fighting. But then the signature moves begin to seem familiar and recognition hits. They realize who they're each fighting. The blindfolds come off and they team up together. They battle villains like Steel Jacket, Killer Croc, King Snake in this very savage brawl. Wildcat takes his grief out on Killer Croc and for beating him senseless for Hector's death. Then it's Wildcat versus Ernie Chubb. Ted leans on his old school technique and flattens the wannabe mogul with the final insult, "You're just another bum that didn't make it to the big time." Lockup tries one last sneak attack. Bad move. Wildcat and Batman land matching sucker punches and shut the club down for good. So that's Batman Wildcat. I'm going to give a recap of Catwoman Wildcat, and then we'll just talk about it all together. So here we go. Round two. Ding, ding. Catwoman Wildcat from 1998, a year later. So Ted Grant staggers into his hotel room after a Wildcat bust, bruised but noble. As he ices his knuckles, memories surface of the frame-up job from his superheroic origin. Ted is still fighting, but only the good fight. Meanwhile, after her own Catwoman heist scheme, Selina Kyle towel dries and heads down to the casino. Selina bumps into Ted at the bar, charming him with talk of clean champs. The flirtatious pair verbally spar over who is going to win the upcoming boxing title fight. Then comes the mobsters for the Volpe crime family. There's the moronic behemoth called Clawhammer, the Dragna twins, Fifi the torturer, and Buffalo the bruiser, and their plan is to rob the Klondike casino during the big title fight. Now, Jocko Volpe, his gang, gets ready to set up Selina to take the fall for the robbery, but Catwoman, she's too sharp. And on the roof, Wildcat eventually comes face-to-face with Catwoman and her whip. Our protagonists trade blows and a quick surprise kiss, and they figure out each other's angle and team up to crash the heist.
Now this erotica's got BDSM vibes coming in because you said Catwoman and her whip. Like, you were very specific about zooming in on that.
I'm leaving that in. where were we? All right, so Clawhammer's crew, they storm the cash office, nails are flying, blood is spilling, but Selina and Ted spring to their surprise and stop the bad guy's getaway helicopter midair. Unfortunately, what goes up must come down. So Wildcat and Catwoman dodge the colliding chopper by taking cover in the Klondike rooftop roller coaster ride. Our heroes then drop straight into a mob war with getaway buses and crooked enforcers. There's tension, there's a maybe kiss, and then there's a bus chase that would make Sandra Bullock jealous, where Selina bowls goons out the door like human bowling pins. An enforcer called Red Blade then arrives and incinerates half the underworld. Ted gets captured by the mob while Selina takes off with the loot, but then she regrets abandoning Wildcat. She heads off to rescue Ted from a tropical island mob hideout, crawling with Komodo dragons and literal torture chambers. There we meet Luco Volpe, the big bad and the head of the Volpe gang. He delights in torture and drills and cattle prods, including on Ted and Luco's own brothers. Now, he's demanding answers about the missing cash. Ted refuses to scream. He eventually ends up breaking free, and just as the bad guy is about to slice him like deli meat, Catwoman intervenes. Flamethrowers ignite, oxygen tanks explode, and the moronic Clawhammer, who's now missing his hands, snaps Luco's neck like a breadstick. Selina saves Clawhammer, loading him into the chopper. Ted leaps from the fiery rubble, and they kiss into the sunset, and Selina suggests to Ted that they should head to someplace nice for their next date. There we go. That's both miniseries. Lots to unpack here. I will say, just to kick it off, like, it's interesting how the two series feel very different. Like, the Batman Wildcat series feels like a 1990s Batman plot. It really does, you know, with a violent bad guy fight club, whereas Catwoman Wildcat feels very much like a 1990s, you know, madcap heist movie, you know, including like a bonkers runaway bus, just like in Speed. Now, I haven't, and this is a question for you, I have not read a ton of 1990s Catwoman books. They just didn't appeal to me. So I don't know if this feels like a Catwoman plot. So, like, how did you see the two miniseries, like, in a contrast kind of view?
Yeah, I think the greatest contrast for me was one had, I think, a sense of gravitas to it, and the other one I really couldn't take seriously whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And that was either intentional and even, like, in a meta way, like, one of the characters, no one was taking him seriously. So it's like, well, now it's this whole thing. And there was a bit too much going on, I think, in Wildcat, Catwoman, Wildcat. Wildcat. Whereas I think Batman Wildcat had a singular focus. And I think it really held on to that and carried it through the end. So, I mean, that would be my main thing is I took Batman Wildcat. I took seriously, but I just couldn't take Catwoman Wildcat very seriously.
And I think you got a point there. Like, you know, I feel the same way. I enjoyed Batman Wildcat a lot. I mean, there's some good things to say about Catwoman Wildcat, but overall, yeah, it's not as good. And I think it sort of stands to reason. Like, okay, we had the first miniseries. It was so successful. It got a sequel. There was no third one. And I think that speaks to the Catwoman Wildcat series didn't do well. Now, maybe the sales numbers were there, but fan reaction wasn't, or maybe the sales numbers dropped off immediately after issue one. I don't know. I don't mind that they feel like different types of stories. I'm fine with that. But yeah, quite frankly, the Catwoman Wildcat, it was so confusing. Like, I actually had to write down the plot. So I'm going to tell you guys the plot of the story here, like, because I didn't get it until I had to do that write-up that I just read. So the Catwoman Wildcat plot is not easy to follow, right? So there's these mob guys, right? And they run a casino, and they've been skimming profits from their own casino. So much so that they cannot cover the bets that the patrons made to pay out when this fight ends, this big title fight. They can't pay out that. So they rob their own casino for the cash to ensure that they don't have to pay out the bets, and setting up Catwoman to take the fall. But then their boss, their older brother, finds out about Hold the Skimming, and he ends up torturing and murdering his own brothers for the money. So, like, that was not real evident to me when I finished the book. That wasn't clear as day. Like, I didn't get that they ran the casino themselves. It was their casino. I didn't pick up on that till later. So it took, again, two reads to get that. So it's unfortunate that it was a little hard to understand.
Yeah, I think when I texted you that one of, you know, I liked one of them, I didn't like one of them.
Yeah.
And I think I even mentioned in our conversation, like, I just got lost in the sauce.
Yeah.
Because they're just like a lot of extraneous side details. And then just character commentary was a bit odd. And yeah, it was just hard to follow. And I feel like that's not typical. I think Catwoman, I've read some Catwoman stuff in the 90s and, and early 2000s, mainly, again, where she was interacting with Bat Family characters and some of these crossovers and things like that. But this didn't feel to me like the typical Catwoman story.
Okay.
I was thinking to myself, does she typically go out of town, you know, on an adventure? And I guess she does. I couldn't back up saying no, because I feel like maybe she doesn't stay in Gotham City all the time. But it just seemed... It seemed like an odd thing, and also a bit silly. Like, did she not? She didn't get paid at all. She stole that money. And I feel like, shouldn't she be wise enough to get half of the money and then complete the job and get the second half? Because her whole thing was to basically disable the security system, as far as I could tell.
Right.
So that the robbery could be, quote unquote, easier. And then it was end up going to get pinned on her. But she didn't, I think, get any of that money that she was promised initially.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. And yeah, at the end, she does get the $3 million.
Yes.
That the mob was going to get. And she had to spend $1 million of it just to find out where Wildcat was being held. So yeah, you're right. I didn't mind her leaving Gotham to go to Vegas for an adventure because she was getting paid. But when she went to this tropical island that gangsters run, that was a bit, and she was in a weird green camo costume.
Yes.
Like, which is kind of, I mean, from a guy point of view, it's like, oh, that's sexy. But then realistically, like, really, what's going on here? So it didn't work for me. Also, like, the art contrast is dramatic. I mean, first of all, it is the 90s, folks. There's no hiding that. It's the 90s, right? Yeah. I mean, roided muscles, giant crazy poses, stuff like that. But there is a definite art contrast between the two series, even though it's the same penciler. And I think it's the presence of the female co-lead, which it is, because, you know, there is a Jim Ballant, I guess, effect of Catwoman in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe what's happening here. You know, there's a lot of racy art, you know, a lot of male gaze, a lot of cheesecake. I showed some of the pages to my wife and she was like, oh my God, you gotta be, like, she knew to expect some cheesecake in a guy superhero comic, but she's like, oh my gosh, really? So it was over the top.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that her art and just like the layout and framing was distracting and not in a good way. I mean, the first time you see her, I think there are at least 3 butt shots on the same page. And then you, of course, when in your synopsis, we're talking about, she's drying herself off with a towel. I was like, well, that's generous.
I mean, that's exactly, she's coming out of the shower and she's, you know, like, that's the first shot we see, or no, I guess not the first shot. She's already done some crime as Catwoman, but yeah, it's like, come on, really? Now, as a dude, yeah, she's hot, but I don't, the art didn't do it for me. So let's talk about Batman Wildcat some more. So you like this one. That's good.
I do like this one. Yes. I actually have a question.
Uh-oh.
Which is, it's going to be like a really niche question, and it might be unfair to put you on the spot, but looking at Hector Ramirez, seems like there might have been some training, like he would have known Ted Grant to a certain extent. I mean, Ted does call him in, quote unquote, an amigo to Killer Croc at the end. And then you have Yolanda. I just wonder where Ted's training ring is and whether it's in a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood.
Oh, interesting. I would assume it's Gotham City, because that's usually kind of his stomping ground as far as I know. And I think the JSA were in Gotham City in the recent JSA series prior to this. So I think it's probably Gotham City. And he does tend to rather get down there with the common man. He's not going to be the highfalutin one in the gated community, you know, Jim. It's going to be where the where the common people are. So it could very well be Hispanic community. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, I think that's lovely. I don't put it past him. I mean, there are certainly some elitist, I think, heroes out there. And so, yeah, I think Ted Grant is not one of them. Yes, I think that this was a great story. This is actually my second time reading it. Mm-hmm. It sounded familiar when you gave me the comics that we were reading. But then I was thinking, why was I reading this? And then Oracle popped up and I thought, oh, okay, so this is why. So I think I probably have covered it on my own show, but I don't think my opinions or anything have changed. I love how Batman and Wildcat are on the same case, but they have different reasons for investigating that case. Wildcat, I think, definitely has more of a personal investment in what's going on. And Batman, I think he's still kind of worried probably about, is Wildcat somehow involved, but it's not as personal. And then they both end up at the end and they're like at odds unintentionally. Yeah, I love seeing the cast of characters. Lockup is someone that I've encountered because I feel like he was a guard or is a guard at Blackgate from time to time. Like, I feel like I've seen him before, so it was interesting seeing him. And then just if we're talking about him, Wildcat being more, with the blue collar workers and people in different neighborhoods, you have the complete opposite. So there's a bit of a social commentary, I think, in terms of wealth and class, because, you know, this guy who's running the secret ring, he's doing it all for entertainment, but the only people who can afford that are the rich people. And of course, he's getting rich off it as well, and he's rich. But the people who are suffering are the ones who cannot afford such luxuries. So I really like that there's that depth here that, it's a fight comic and you get some heroes fighting together, but also there's heart to it because Ted potentially was training Hector Ramirez. And he was killed. Hector was killed wearing Ted Grant's Wildcat. So that's going to hurt. And then you have this socioeconomic status commentary as well. So I feel like it's for three issues. They're getting into a lot without it like being in our face.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about the socioeconomic issues around it. And they specifically lay out Ernie to be an interesting villain, Ernie Chubb, because he's not just a big dumb bruiser. He's really smart. He's very intelligent. And he is planning an assault. And he's really playing a lot of people, too. Like, he's playing lockup to, you know, only capture villains. So it's only villains, really, that are fighting each other. And so that's what people are... So he's appealing to lockup, who has sort of a... I don't know. He thinks he's doing the right thing by locking up bad guys, but then he's letting them beat each other to death, which is not the right thing. So Ernie Chubb is doing that again. It's another form of subjugation that Ernie's putting forward. Yeah. So I hadn't thought about the fact that only the uber rich can watch it, but everyone else is suffering. That's a great point, huh?
Yeah, because it starts off the first time you see Bruce Wayne, he's talking with that Devlin jerk, right? Oh, and God, Devlin's like, "Oh, have you watched it?" You know, that sort of thing.
And that dude's total sleaze. Absolutely 1%er. He's gross. Now there is a little bit of cheesecake in there because like Devlin's got a girl on, you know, a hottie or something like that. But that's about the only girl in the whole thing. It's almost entirely men in this comic,
with the exception of Babs.
Great point. That's right.
Pull her up though and see what she. But I don't recall being upset with her.
No, they didn't. I don't think they sexualized her at all. I mean, she's working out, but that's, you know, her upper body. But that's nothing unusual, and I don't think they really overdid it. So I want to go back to Hector Ramirez for just a second. One of the things about him as the Wildcat protege is that they say in the comic he went 90 minutes fighting Killer Croc. That's crazy. Yeah. Like anybody, any normal human surviving against Killer Croc for 90 minutes, unless Killer Croc's playing with him, that's a lot. That's just a lot about the kid. And he could have really been a great, you know, next Wildcat if this hadn't happened to him.
Absolutely. Yeah. Speaks to his abilities as well as I'm assuming to Ted's training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when the fights are happening, though, the only thing I had a little bit of an issue is that, like, the villains come out and they're totally into the fight. They're, like, ready to fight each other to the death. And there's no real discussion of why they're so into it. If I was a villain, I'd be like, hey, let's team up and get the heck out of here.
Yeah.
Right? So one way that that could have been done better or is done better later, which leads me to a question, which is, you know, Roulette. You heard about her in Justice League Unlimited. I'm sure you've run across her in other comics now at this point. She runs an organization very much like this, you know? Mm-hmm. So is Roulette a ripoff of the Secret Ring?
Oh, interesting. Potentially. Yeah, I think the shtick is the same, except she goes metahuman to metahuman. Yeah. And I think what were they doing? It was just anyone potentially that they kidnapped or took.
Yeah. Well, they're all supervillains, though. It's the one guy who uses venom to bulk up. It's KG Beast. It's Killer Croc. So that most of them had some sort of power or gimmick, at least. So I feel like it is a ripoff to some extent. I mean, you know, Geoff Johns had to have read this because it's Wildcat, right? He loves the JSA. So, and I'm not saying Geoff purposely ripped it off and maybe just was in the back of his head or Fight Clubs exist in other places too. I mean, it's, you know, there's a movie called Fight Club and all this stuff, but it feels like maybe the Roulette thing should have paid a little more homage and said something like maybe she took over the Secret Ring operation or something to at least acknowledge it. But now, one thing that Roulette did do better, which is where I was going with all this, is that she would drug the people who fought in her organization so that they were into the fight. So that's the one thing I think was sort of missing here.
Mm-hmm. And the people were actually there, right? The audience members?
Yeah. Yep, exactly right. Yeah. Well, pay-per-view might not have been a thing by then.
That's true, yeah.
So one thing I noticed in here that I think you would have enjoyed is that Batman likes his caffeine.
Hashtag Dr. Ange. I guess he has to have it in order to work late.
I guess so. I just thought it was sort of funny. They made a point of Alfred handing him a coffee mug. And, you know, Batman's asking Alfred, who's been by his side, you know, like his entire life, is there caffeine in this? Like, really?
It's like, yeah, by this point, you need to trust that Alfred knows what he's doing. Come on. Right. But this is, I mean, Bat Jerk is a micromanager, so we should all we should all recognize this by now, people.
Absolutely. And I will say one other thing. It's something weird that occurred to me when I read this that I've never considered any time in my life for any reason, but like, Alfred's there every day, right? Mm-hmm. He's a former spy. He's their guy who patches them up. He is technically the butler, but he's also kind of a father figure. He's still wearing a tuxedo every single day at his job. Like, I would stop doing that after a certain number of years when the butler aspect is more of a pretense than anything.
Yeah. I guess he just takes it seriously and maybe he likes the visual aspect of it.
Yeah, could be. Yeah, then a little bit of elegant society could be.
Yeah.
So I'll ask you for before we move on to the Catwoman story, is this more of a Batman story or a Wildcat story?
Oh, I feel like it's decently 50-50, to be honest. If anything, it might lean towards Batman a bit, especially because you've got some of his rogues in there. Mm-hmm. Lockup would have been someone that that readers would have known about, and of course, Killer Croc. But because I think there's such a personal connection with the initial death, the initial fight to Wildcat, that's why I think that weight still carries 50% of it.
Interesting. Okay. Because we came at this from different angles. Because, you know, I went through my Batman phase and that's behind me now. I still love Batman, but I'm not obsessed with him.
Sure.
But I am obsessed with the JSA. So I saw this as a Wildcat story and barely a Batman story. But now that you mentioned the villains, that does elevate it some. So, I mean, I would probably put it like a 60% Wildcat, 40% Batman. That would be my take. But you're coming at it from a whole different angle and probably see it more clearly than me. So
I wouldn't say that. But I mean, when you throw Oracle in there like that, I think is a bit different though. However, she is like the main information broker for everybody at this point in time. So I guess she could pop up, and we're seeing Alfred. So when we start to see these like minor cast characters or his main cast characters, Tim Drake was in there, then I'm like, oh, what's, yeah. So 50-50 for me. But yes, I think I understand where you're coming from too.
Well, now that I flip through it, I mean, there is a lot of Batman in here. So maybe you're right. Maybe I'm just seeing what I want to see because I'm thinking about Wildcat. Yeah. Uh-huh.
The other issue is, but they probably did this for selling. billing purposes. I mean, Batman is the first name on there, and that's true for Catwoman, because I feel like people might not be as aware of who Wildcat is, which is unfortunate when you have to like come down to it, but yeah.
Well, I imagine between these two miniseries, you know, first of all, putting him in the Guy Gardner series, doing the showcase issue story, then doing Batman Wildcat, then Catwoman Wildcat. I imagine, you know, Chuck Dixon and Beau Smith were trying to steer towards a, you know, Wildcat series, ongoing series. I'm sure that's what that was hopeful for. Because, I mean, again, we mentioned Chuck Dixon wrote the Robin issue with Wildcat, and Beau Smith wrote the Guy Gardner issues with Wildcat. So they're both pushing the Wildcat agenda. Just, I don't know whether the Catwoman Wildcat thing brought it all crashing down or just the interest wasn't there. I don't know. So let's talk about Catwoman Wildcat. There's some negative, but there's also some positive things to say. Mm-hmm. I think Clawhammer, who again is this giant gorilla of a villain, he's stupid. I mean, he literally is stupid. In the story, he is not bright. And I adored him.
Oh, really?
It was just, it was fun because it was very tongue-in-cheek. I enjoyed that aspect of it. I don't know. So you tell me your feelings on Clawhammer.
Yeah, I think it was fun, I guess, in the beginning, but when he consistently had to correct people about his name, I started to get a little bit annoyed by issue 3 and 4, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, I he was not my favorite, but I guess if you're like not taking, I was trying to take it seriously, so I guess maybe that's why, but if maybe I went in with a different mindset, like don't take this story seriously, I would have enjoyed it a bit more. So that's my call to action for people reading this, is like maybe go in with a different mindset if you're reading Catwoman Wildcat.
Yeah, I think you definitely got to see the silly in it. Again, Clawhammer, Fifi the Torturer, you know, Buffalo the Bruiser, Weed. I mean, it's the mob guys are so ridiculous, like almost like a not quite a Cannonball Run level ridiculousness, but I mean, they're just silly. And Clawhammer is literally basing his idea on the back of a hammer, like that literally claw. And he like carries a nail gun and he's constantly making really dumb, you know, hardware puns and stuff like that. So if you look at it from that aspect, I found that piece more enjoyable than, say, like Red Blade, who was a straightforward mercenary who just burned everyone. Like, I feel like Red Blade wasn't even necessary for the story. I feel like he was way over the top and just distracted from the other stuff.
Well, it really takes a turn, I would say, the end of 3 and then 4, because then there's just wholesale slaughter.
Yeah.
So it just really, if we're supposed to be lighthearted and making fun of Clawhammer, that's fine. But then I can't really reconcile that with the bloodbath and torture that's happening at the end.
Yeah. And Clawhammer was brutal too. They rob, again, they're robbing their own casino.
Yeah.
And then he uses the nail gun to murder all the people in the cash counting room. You know, it's just pretty nasty. Now, that my favorite thing though about Clawhammer was somebody was fussing about him and he described Clawhammer as your hardware loving sling blade talking brother, which about dropped me to the floor. Now you're a little kid. You may not even remember the movie Sling Blade.
I remember.
Okay.
Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah, exactly right. And so just the idea of Clawhammer going, you know, all that kind of thing was just, because I hadn't thought about that movie in 30 years, just cracked me up.
Wow.
So let's pull the Band-Aid off. Let's do this. All right. Wildcat and Catwoman have a romance in here. And she says it's originally based on an old Skrull girl crush because he trained her how to fight, apparently. So it does not sit well with you, it sounds like.
It does not. I do want to have an aside and just say the fact that he doesn't recognize her, I think, is a bit strange, especially the flashback was not long. But I think if anyone is training with somebody for a significant amount of time, you would recognize them. I might not be able to name all of my students by this point, you know, ones that I started off with, but I'm going to recognize that I know them. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he doesn't recognize her at the bar, I had an issue with. My issue, it's the same thing, I think, with the reason why I hate Batman and Batgirl. Any sort of thought of them getting together is that there's this power dynamic that I think is problematic. And because of that teacher-student relationship, and so even though they've aged up out of that, I think that that's still kind of there. And so that's why I have an issue of it. So I can't really separate Catwoman from the fact that she trained under him as a child.
Okay. Well, I'll play counterpoint to it. So the, now the artist we've already said is drawing Sirius Cheesecake, and the way he draws her, she's not a child there. Now,
no.
She might be 18. So okay, sure, okay. Still young enough that he, you know, he would be in his 60s probably by then because he's been alive since 1920 or something like that. So yeah, you're probably there probably is a level of inappropriateness there. That is fair. And that goes back to the thing earlier though where you said you'd be okay dating him, but that's because I guess he didn't train you. Is that so you're worried about the grooming aspect?
There's no power imbalance there because I have no relationship to him in any sort of professional capacity.
No, I get it. As a teacher, these are probably things that are on your mind. I get that. Yeah, so that's fair. I don't necessarily see that the same way, but I totally see where you're coming from. I totally understand your perspective and say that is absolutely a valid point. I kind of like seeing them together in this romantic capacity because I don't focus on the teacher aspect of it, but I totally see where you're coming from. So I'm not saying you're wrong. I mean, you're wrong about a lot of things, not this one.
Excuse me.
So if you look at this though, so far we've established, Wildcat's got a romantic connection to Catwoman. Mm-hmm. He's got a romantic connection to Lady Blackhawk. Mm-hmm. I found out in my research, he hooked up with Hippolyta.
Whoa.
Because as many of you know, Hippolyta traveled back in time to the 1940s and operated as the Wonder Woman of World War II. And mm-hmm. so she was there as a fellow JSA member with Wildcat. And they revealed in issue 185 of Wonder Woman from 2002 that Wildcat and Hippolyta were snuggling a lot and very friendly. So
I'm surprised. I thought she was off the wee-wee.
Well, at least in 2002, under Phil Jimenez, I guess she wasn't. So
I see.
And yeah, so Ted's a playa. So there we go. Now, this Catwoman sort of romance does continue, sort of, kind of, like what they did in the JSA series. I remember very specifically, there's a great issue where Ted's, like, leg is broken or something, I want to say. Or maybe it's
again?
His arm. Well, just one of them. And he's healing. But he's stuck at the JSA headquarters. And he's like just kind of hanging out of the place. And there's a break in. It's a fantastic issue. So he's on the phone. He's like in the bathtub. And he's talking with Catwoman. And he's saying things like, you know, hey, you know, what are you wearing, Selena? That kind of thing. So it's still very flirtatious sort of thing. So, the romance at least is suggested to continue for a while. Or at least the flirting, which is so.
Do you think that this relationship, though, is a poor man's version of Catwoman and Batman?
Well, I suppose, I mean, certainly Catwoman and Batman is the ideal pairing, right? For both Batman and Catwoman. Like, those are the one true pairing. But mm-hmm. I guess I didn't think of it as a poor man's version, because, I mean, you could argue Wildcat is a poor man's Batman, and you could make that argument, I suppose. Well, they both wear black costumes with pointy ears and punch people, and both came out of the 1940s-ish type era. But I guess I didn't think of it as a poor man's Batman, but, I mean, she could be settling, I suppose, maybe.
I regret. Now that you've used my words against me, I regret how I phrased it.
Well, where were you going with it?
Oh, just like a different iteration, I guess, of kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
Where it's this thief and he's like, you can't do that. And they get together.
Well, and that begs the question, does every story with Catwoman have to involve a hookup?
Uh-oh.
It doesn't.
No, it doesn't. I mean, you know, she deserves her sexual freedom for sure, but no. Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe he's more tolerant than Batman is, because didn't she keep the money?
Yeah, I think they flew off with the money together, really.
Yeah, and that they're actually together, whereas Batman, it's a lot of will they, won't they, but they a lot of times don't.
It was the mob's money, so maybe that he was okay with it. I don't know.
True. Dirty money. I mean, Barbara did the same thing where she stole all Blockbuster's money, so.
Ah, there you go. As long as she puts it to good use.
There you go.
So I ask you a similar question. Is this a Catwoman or a Wildcat story?
Oh. I think it's, for me, this leans more Catwoman because of all the heisty stuff.
I'm right there with you. I agree. I think this is more Catwoman. Yeah. Now, I mean, Wildcat certainly has a lot to do. But it's not a personal this time because it's not, you know, his buddy, the boxer kind of thing. Yeah. And it is the formula of heist and madcap sort of things feels more Catwoman to me. So, yeah.
I did wonder what you thought when we first see Ted, because he's beating up some goons at the very beginning. And then he unwraps his hands and his hands are all jacked up. And he says, like, good thing I'm still keeping in shape. I wondered if his hands would still be messed up after being such a, like, he's been a pugilist for years now. Would they really look that way?
That's a good question. Well, I mean, in theory, when you're a pugilist, you're wearing the boxing gloves, so you've got the padding there. But here, he's punching bare-knuckled. If you go back and look, he's punching bare-knuckled face-to-face. So I think you could definitely say he's damaging. But he should have some pretty thick calluses there, that's for sure.
That's what I'm thinking, yeah. And that's why I always prefer, maybe it was just in JLU episode, but I like when his fingers are taped up.
I like that look too. Some people don't. I really liked it when he's got them, got the hands taped up. I think it looks cooler. That kind of came about in the later 90s or in the JSA series. And I like that look. And I like that it's stuck. And again, some people, purists, don't like it. I'm a fan.
Yeah, I think it also makes sense. I think it's realistic that he wouldn't be, if his whole thing are his fists, he's going to take care of them and he's going to protect them like that. So
good point. It's his career. Yeah. So, looking holistically, would you recommend one or both of these miniseries to other people who may be a fan of either Batman, Wildcat, or Catwoman?
Yeah, I definitely would lean towards, if you're a fan of Wildcat and you're looking for a good story, I would lean towards Batman and Wildcat.
Right there with you. Completely echo what you said. Totally co-sign that. So now, Stella, we have the difficult task of the All-Star Award. This is where we each nominate a favorite moment from the issues, whether it's like a story beat or something in the art, something that made us laugh, whatever. Both myself and Stella will pick one moment each to spotlight, and both of those moments will earn an All-Star Award. So, Stella, you're the guest, unfortunately for me. So what is your pick for the All-Star Award?
Oh, it's one from each story, though, right?
Or you can just pick one. No, I was just going to pick one total. I'm not picking one from the Catwoman story.
Okay. I think for me, I will pick one from each because I want to give something redeeming to the Catwoman. I like Wildcat at the very end when he is facing off against Killer Croc and talking about Hector and giving a lot of props to Hector while also beating up Killer Croc. So that whole page in issue 3, I really like.
Okay.
And something in the Catwoman story, I appreciated him talking about why he came out of retirement, which is a very small story beat, but Selena asks, and he was talking about like he felt like he needed to, and the world needed him and people like him because Superman and some of these big characters are off doing these really big threats that he can't necessarily help out with. And he knows that there are people there that needs him. And I felt like, isn't that who Wildcat is when you come down to it? And so I thought that was a really beautiful moment.
That's really nice. That's great. I like that. My pick, I'll go ahead and pick one from each as well then. Batman Wildcat, that story, I liked at the end when he takes down the big bad Ernie Chubb. And there's this great page where he's just beating the shaz out of Ernie. And he's saying basically like, you know, I should have never stopped hunting down creeps like you. Then there wouldn't be a need for other Wildcats. And so he beats the crap out of the guy, takes him down. At the end, he just says, you're just another bum that didn't make it to the big time. And I just really like that because it's about being a Wildcat and it's also about the boxing career. And I just think that's a nice marrying of both of his sort of passions in life. So that one spoke to me. Then on Catwoman, Wildcat, I'm just going to pick a silly one. There's a great moment where there's a tour bus that the bad guys steal, right? And then Catwoman and Wildcat end up on the bus and they're, you know, this crazy heist thing. Catwoman's driving the bus. She's knocking goons out the door and everything. So she's driving full speed. Again, this is 1998, right? Not too long after the movie Speed. And she actually says to herself, now what would Sandra Bullock do? Say something cool and do something crazy. And so she literally drives into a parking garage, shearing off the top of the bus. And I love that moment. First of all, that it acknowledges the pop culture. It also unfortunately sets it in a firm time of the 90s, whatever. But I just think it's fun. So I like that moment. All right. So congratulations to all of those moments for winning All-Star Awards. Please wear them with pride. They're as tangible as our love for those moments. Aww. Now, Stella, I need to ask a favor. There is blood and unconscious bad guys all over the floor. Would you mind hanging out here for a little bit and making sure this moronic claw hammer doesn't wake up and cause any more trouble?
100%. I've got some bleach that I can use to clean up this place.
Well, thank you, Stella. I appreciate it. Now, don't worry. We will bring you back at the end of the show. But after this podcast promo break, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called The Society Pages. A long time ago, in a comic book rack far, far away, During the years between The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, Marvel Comics kept the Star Wars magic alive, delivering bold new stories, expanding the mythology, and taking our favorite heroes and villains on unforgettable adventures. Now join me, the irredeemable Shag, and an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we journey back to this incredible era. We begin with a comic adaptation of The Empire Strikes Back and continue through the thrilling tales leading up to Return of the Jedi. If you're a seasoned Star Wars veteran who knows your Shira Bree from your hoojibs, or a brave explorer venturing into these comics for the first time, this is your hyperspace lane to classic Star Wars adventure. Join us for Marvel Star Wars, From Empire to Jedi, every other month on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. The Society Pages. And the Society Pages is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episode. Now, before we do that, a little bit of news. Just announced at the time of this recording, there are solicitations for the new JSA series. Issue number 13 kicks off a new 6-part story called JSA Year One, continuing to be written by Jeff Lemire with art by Gavin Goodry. So again, it's going to be JSA issues 13 through 18. Now, for those of you who are diehard JSA fans, are they going to be faithful to previous tellings of the JSA's origin? Probably not. But you know what? I'm interested to see what this team could bring us. I want to see how it develops, and I'm always game for more JSA stories. And let's face it, they've been around 85 years. Do they have to be completely beholden to the original stories? Now, I know some of you would say yes, and that's okay. So you know what? Leave your thoughts in the feedback on how you feel about this new JSA Year One story coming our way. Also, if you've seen the new Superman movie, I hope you noticed the Hall of Justice mural that was painted along the roof line of the inside of Hall of Justice. And James Gunn released some high-res photos of that mural. And a lot of All-Star Squadron characters and a lot of JSA characters appear in there. And the interesting thing is, it's a timeline if you read it from left to right. So one of the things that sort of stood out to me was that Wildcat is not in the World War II area with the other JSA and All-Star Squadron members. He's much closer to modern day, which makes me wonder, what does that mean for Wildcat in the new James Gunn DC Cinematic Universe? I'm interested to know. And then last, this isn't really news, but just happy birthday to ourselves. August 1st was, in fact, our 1-year anniversary of the very first episode of JSA in the 90s, so we're officially 1 year old. All right, now get on the social media, folks. I always say this. Find us on social media as JSA Presents. Share your thoughts there, because it is always about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. And also, if you want your comments right in the air, be sure you leave those on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA. Now, first up, we're going to cover an iTunes or Apple Podcast review. So if you haven't left a review yet, please consider it. It really does help raise the profile of the show and attracts new listeners. So you can look on iTunes or Apple Podcast for Justice Society Presents. And if you're outside of the United States and you happen to leave a review, please just let me know, because I'll have to filter to your specific country to see that. Now, as a thank you, I'll read your entire review on the air. So our thanks to Olivia's fan, who wrote, "Great show. I'm really enjoying the show. I never got into the JSA. Since I've been listening to your show, I've been reading them on Hoopla. Thanks for doing the show." Well, Olivia's fan, I am thrilled to hear that you're reading the comics now and hope you're really enjoying it. Now, again, folks, you can look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. It's the same thing for Justice Society Presents. Now, I have collected all your feedback from the last episode. I have taken comments from social media. I've also pulled emails and different places that I could find. Most of the bulk of the comments do come from our website, though. So I put it all together in one Google document. It's a lot of words, people. So I am going to make sure I acknowledge every single person and read some portion of their feedback to thank everyone for leaving comments. And this time out, we're covering the previous episode that was a spotlight on Jim Corrigan, the Spectre, with my guest Justin from the Fanholes podcast. First up, we heard from Ryan Daly from the Fire and Water Podcast Network. He has shows such as The Sandman Slept Here, right here on the Justice Society Presents podcast feed. Ryan writes, "I'm so happy this podcast finally got to one of my favorite topics, which is Madame Xanadu naked. Keep up the good work." So glad that we can entertain you, Ryan. Yes, in the feedback section, we read comments from Dustin Gibbons all about his experience as a child taking a Spectre comic to school that involved Madame Xanadu. So Dustin chimed in again. He says, thanks for sharing your story. And he says, something relevant to the JSA, have you been checking out the new history of the DC Universe? He says, the first issue covers the creation up to the JSA being brought before Congress, more or less. It has some JSA goodness and some things which are interesting to me, such as, spoiler, that Dr. Occult is now marked as the first superhero. And he says, that's the end of the spoilers. And this seems to be a change, as the superhero has been Crimson Avenger since post-crisis on Infinite Earths. So, but it doesn't get a mention now in New History of the DC Universe. And he goes on to say it does have some good JSA stuff in the book, and he's enjoying it. Now, Dustin, I've only read the first issue of the New History of the DC Universe. I absolutely loved it. I loved all the JSA stuff. I did notice a few things that I think are retcons, besides just Crimson Avenger versus Dr. Occult. Other things about, you know, I'm just going to say it. So, folks, if you haven't read History of the DC Universe, please fast forward, I don't know, 1 minute or something, so you miss what I'm going to say. But, like, in there, they reveal that, you know, when the JSA retire in the 1950s, right, after the HUAC meeting, rather than them just going into retirement and sort of fading away from public consciousness, in this new history of the DC Universe, they imply that they actually go to the Battle of Ragnarok shortly after that. So they go to the Ragnarok battle in, like, the 1950s, rather than in the 1980s in the last days of the JSA. So that's a huge 30-year change. But at the same time, it kind of makes sense to me, because that way they're not around. That explains why they're not around, you know, taking care of business and helping people through all those years. So just interesting food for thought. Let me know what you think in the comments. There's a few other little nitpicky things here and there, but that was the big one. All right, so let's keep going here. We're here from Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star and the Space Princess and other stories. He says that The Spectre is a rare DC run from the 90s that he had a full run. And we had talked about the comparison between Spectre and Ghost Rider, and Rob says Spectre is a lot like the Ghost Rider, except Ghost Rider's pen and stare gives people exactly what they gave the other people. It's just math. You can't argue with it. Spectre makes up his own punishments, and he's often mean. That's a great point, Rob. I mean, Spectre's vengeance is usually pretty vicious and really nasty, so it's an interesting comparison. They were from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. Bucky says, my introduction to the Spectre comes from the Brave and the Bold cartoon, the same episode where I first met the Phantom Stranger. I'd learned more via the DC Showcase collections of both characters. And then Bucky shares a random JSA fact. He says he's been reading the DC Finest Justice Society collection. In the first collection, in issue 10, Al Pratt reveals that the Hawkman taught him and some of the other members how to talk to birds. Dude, that's crazy. Apparently, the Atom never says who else in the other team learned to talk to birds, but it'd probably be helpful for Dr. Midnight having a pet owl to use that skill. Dude, that's fascinating. I had no idea that was in there. That's just crazy. Thank you for sharing that, Bucky. Then Bucky poses a question. He says, both Wonder Woman and Jesse Quick have both been secretaries to the Justice Society of America, but later both became full-fledged members. So here's my question. If you were to choose a modern female superhero to fill that position now, and at some point she would graduate to full membership, who would you choose? Bucky, I love the question. It's a great idea, something to ponder. For me, I would actually choose no one. I don't like the idea of a secretary position, especially sort of the stereotypical gender issue of making a woman the secretary before they can graduate to full membership. So I'd prefer to just have female members graduate to the team immediately. But it's an interesting idea. And, you know, also maybe a male character starts as a secretary and graduates. Maybe that's how they bring a junior member in. Maybe someone who's like a Stargirl or a JJ Thunder or Cyclone, or I can't remember the name of the magician character that was introduced right before the New 52 started. So the male magician character. So maybe that's how you could do it. You could have a young character be a secretary, I suppose. But either way, good question. Thanks for sharing. And folks, if you have your thoughts, put it in the feedback. Then we're from Brett Miller. It says, the Spectre is one of those characters that I absolutely love in concept. In reality, not so much. Not sure why. I put him in the same category as the Phantom Stranger. Fun, but a bit heavy at times when you need escapism. You know, I totally get that, Brett. It is a heavy book to read. Then we heard from Peter Watson from the Earth 2 podcast. I had put forward a question to the group last time about, I remember the Spectre turning someone into a candle and melting them. And Peter was nice enough to come back with a couple possibilities. He says that those could have been the Wrath of the Spectre from Adventure Comics number 431. At the end of the story, the Ghostly Guardian melts one of the bad guys. His hands elongate and drip off like hot wax. The other, I think, more likely option is from the Nightmare Dummies and the Spectre from Adventure 434. That story is about a guy who uses animated waxwork dummies to go go on a killing spree. The Astral Avenger hunts him down and transforms him into a waxwork dummy, which is scheduled for destruction. The final panel of the story is a close-up of his horrified face melting in the flames, just like that guy from Raiders of the Lost Ark. Spoilers for 1981. And we've covered both those issues as well as the rest of the Spectre Adventure comics run last year on the Earth 2 podcast. So first off, folks, be sure you're checking out the Earth 2 podcast. Peter and David cover an amazing amount of content over there about the JSA. You would absolutely love it, I promise you. Now, as far as those two possibilities, Peter, I think you're absolutely right. I think I'm actually conflating the two because I looked them both up after your suggestion. Thank you for the help. And yeah, that dude's arms melting, I absolutely remember. And then the dude's face melting, I absolutely remember. So I must have conflated the two into like turning him into a candle and lighting his head. Must be what I did. So either way, thank you so much, Peter. I appreciate the help. Heard from Super Captain, who says, fun show, guys. A few years ago, one of my best friends, a fellow comic book fan, loaned me the first four issues of the Austin Germandrake series. I really liked it, but I never got around to reading any more of it. Thanks for the kick in the pants that I needed to seek it out. Also, I love the DC Marvel Amalgam stuff from the 1990s. Matching the Spectre up with Eternity was a good call. In the Amalgam universe, however, he ended up merged with Nightmare as Night Spectre. Oh, Super Captain, I completely forgotten that. That's right. Oh, wow. I may want to reread those Amalgam stuff. They were kind of fun, just crazy pairings. Then we heard from Chris Morris. It's absolutely love this character. I'm kind of late to the DC party, so I didn't read it when it came out, which means I missed out on the glow-in-dark cover. So I'm glad that you brought it to my attention. I genuinely like the artwork and had to make the cover number one the screensaver on my phone. And then Chris says, that page from Armageddon Inferno is absolutely amazing. Who doesn't love to see the Spectre and Firestorm blasting away doing their thing? You know, Chris, I absolutely agree that page from Armageddon Inferno is amazing, and that is probably the only time I'm going to refer to anything from Armageddon Inferno as amazing. They were from Hal. It says, Shag mentioned how there might have been more miniseries of the JSA, like the New Golden Age ones, if they had sold better. And then he asks me, so Shag, are you aware of the interview Jeff Johns did with Popverse around the time he left DC? The answer, Hal, is no, I was not aware of this until I read your comment, and you blew my mind. So Hal goes on to says that Jeff Johns said he had met with editorial about the future of his New Golden Age, and there was quite a lot of enthusiasm about it. There was talk of several more miniseries since the sales were so good, according to him. The new series was in the works that would expand the Justice Society into a Justice Society Global. He made it sound like he and the DC had come to a mutual agreement about the future of the franchise. And then he took six of DC's top artists with him when he left. I don't know how much of that interview was mostly John's self-promotion, or if he really did have an agreement with DC when he left. Something obviously happened if his version of the story is true. Wow, Hal, that is shocking to hear their plans to expand the Justice Society. But it also sort of makes sense, because it felt like when they launched the Justice Society book and those three miniseries, it really did feel like they were building to something. And I think, personally, what sabotaged the whole thing was the ongoing JSA series just couldn't get out in time. I mean, the publication rate was horrible. It was every couple of months. And unfortunately, the story wasn't, the first six issues at least, weren't that interesting, at least to me, were not that interesting. So I think that's actually what sabotage this whole process was the slow release schedule and then the quality of that first story. But that's just me. But thank you so much for sharing that information. It's fascinating. They were from Tim Price from the Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast and the Batgirl Huntress podcast. Tim says, I was all in on this Spectre series since issue number one, since I loved the Ostrander Mandrake Firestorm, and I was glad to get more. Whew, what a ride. I've read it on occasion, but it's been a while. I think my frame of mind just has to be just so, because honestly, I don't gravitate to horror stories in general. I must be too tender-headed for them, so I have to be in a good positive mood to jump into the series so I can enjoy the ride rather than be overly focused on the scary parts. Yeah, Tim, I'm actually right there with you. I typically don't seek out horror-based comics. I don't enjoy them for the most part. The Spectre one really sat well with me. I don't know if it's because it was it's set in the DC universe. I don't know if it's because of the Mandrake art. I don't know what is about it. I enjoy it quite a bit, but it's heavy, and horror comics in general aren't typically my thing. So Tim keeps going. He says, the characters that get me through the book are absolutely Amy and Father Kramer. They bring so much heart and compassion to offset Spectre's vengeance. And the issue by guest artist Jim Aparo is incredible, with a simply delicious twist to the story. Mwahahaha. That's great, Tim. Wonderful. And thank you for reminding me about the Jim Aparo issue. I completely forgot about that. That's so cool. All right. Then we heard from my buddy M.A. Salko. It says, good stuff, gang. I never made the Freddy Krueger connection before listening to this episode. The similarity with Ironic Kills is strong, especially for the later Elm Street films. Then he says, Ostringer Mandrake is certainly a high watermark for the Spectre. I fell off about midway point and need to finish it on Infinite. My July was spent reading the Mensch run, and that was a choice. As flimsy as the back off of that run was, I still was disappointed in the retcons for Madame Xander and Kim Leong. You know, Salko, I have not heard a lot of people praise the Doug Mensch era of Spectre. In fact, I bought all those issues years ago, back when the Ostrich series was going. I bought them as back issues, and I'm like, woohoo, more Spectre. And I don't know that I ever finished reading them. Like, they just didn't grab me. So I'd be interested to know if there's any people out here who want to cheerlead the Doug Mensch version of the Spectre, that series. All right. There was Symbol Pending, who runs the Power Girl blog entitled Symbol Pending. They say, whilst I was at the time deep into the Vertigo line at the time, ironically, I never really been into the horror side of comics, so I really only knew the Spectre when he was being the Ghost of Christmas Future in things like Kingdom Come. That said, it was really fun to listen to you both wax lyrical about the Spectre series, even if to me it sounds like they're telling the same basic story of some bad person getting ironic punishment while someone else seems to fancy Corrigan, even if they can never have true love. I mean, you really just sum it up. I mean, that pretty much is it. Somebody gets punished and somebody wants to be the Corrigan and they can't. That is pretty much it. You're right. Alright, then we're from Diablo Frank from the World Spine Podcasting Network. He has shows such as DC Secret Files Podcast, and he's my co-host on the Blue Devil episodes of Once Upon a Geek. He calls me to task. I kept saying Doug Mink last episode, or however I was saying it. He points out that it's Mensch, just like the Yiddish word that means, like, you know, good guy or stand-up guy. So that's how you say Doug Mensch's last name. So I will endeavor to get that correct, Frank. I guarantee within a week I will forget already, though. Then Frank shares a lot of thoughts on the Ostrander series. He's not as high on it as a lot of other people, so as usual, Frank's being contrary. So let's hear what he has to say. Again, I'm just pulling bits and pieces. His actual comments are much longer and quite fascinating, actually. So if you go out to the website and read all those. But he says, I'm not sure why I burned through the first 8 issues of the Ostrander Matrix series, but I probably wanted to brush up on the Spectre before covering him in the 3rd episode of my DC Secret Files podcast. You guys really should have done the same, since it was a more natural stopping point in the story. Well, Frank, I'll argue with you, because that's a fun thing to do. We read the first 4 issues because that was the original first trade paperback. And you're saying we should have gone to issue 8. I would say you're wrong. Yay, that's fun to say. You should actually go to issue 12. Issue 12 is the most natural stopping point. It comes to, I don't want to spoil it, but the storyline with the bad guy, the serial killer, comes to a conclusion. Let's just put it that way. So issue 12 is actually the natural stopping point. So on you, Frank. That's my intellectual comeback for the day. Then Frank goes on to say, reading the rest of these issues as a proper adult at decades removed, I can certainly see the Freddy Krueger of it all, but it lacks the gleeful gruesomeness. It's po-faced in its EC Comics revivalism, and all the depressive biblical allusions aren't nearly as fun. They intentionally try to straddle the line between DC and Vertigo, but a lot of it is gross demon boobies and graphic violence married to ham-fisted melodramatic moralizing. Then later he says, I wish there was more conflict in the Jim Corrigan portrayal. More anything, really. He mostly pouts and then throws tantrums, and that's his emotional spectrum for those 8 issues. The book is all about him, his drive, his lust, his fear, and his anger, but Corrigan doesn't make me feel anything. He's a collection of elements to drive the narrative, but there's no person there. Huh. I don't know that I agree with that, Frank. I feel like I did get a lot of insight into Corrigan in those first 4 issues, but maybe you had a different perspective on it. And then he says, it's a thing that I'm inclined to take or leave as I please. I started it, and it was all right. I set it down. I may pick it up again, but I don't think my life will be significantly affected whether I do or don't. All right. Well, that's certainly something to consider there. Then Frank finishes his novella-like comment by saying, you'd think I'd be certain of the phrasing after Shag recited words to the effect of, quote, something to consider, 15 friggin' times regarding my various contrarian stances. But the Fire and Water Podcast Network's HR/PR department's anodyne auto-reply just doesn't hit the same as, quote, what's this mad bastard on about now? Yeah, that is, in fact, exactly what I feel when I read your comments, Frank. All right, up next is Ward Hill Terry from the band Stop Calling Me Frank. Terry says, another show about the Spectre and still no mention of Percival Pop the Super Cop. Shameful. Thank you, Terry, for calling us out on a very valid point that nobody cares about but you. I love you, Terry, but you're so cranky. Then Terry says, the Spectre can do anything after the bad stuff happens. Then he writes a little script. He writes, victim, help me, I'm being attacked. And then every other hero says, here I come, take that, you ruffian. But the Spectre says, I'll wait until the ruffian has done what he wants to do, then I will devise an appropriate response. The victim, who's dead, says, that doesn't help me at all. That is actually a really good summation, Terry, of the Spectre and how not helpful he is to people in peril. That's a great point. Then we're from Sean Ross from the Fire and Water Podcast Network, who does shows like Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast. Sean says, great episode, guys. The 90s Spectre run was really something special. I'm actually glad they didn't make it a Vertigo book. For some reason, keeping his horror-tinged stories grounded in the larger DC universe made them more terrifying and powerful. You know, Sean, I think I agree. I feel it made them more, I don't want to say real, but it made them feel more connected to other material I knew, right? You know, when you see a superhero in there, you're like, oh, this could happen to somebody I care about, not just a made-up, you know, random independent comic. So, good point. Then Then Sean says, also, this has to be one of the earliest comics to make HIV a plot point in a more serious manner, right? I know that Extrano in The New Guardians and Northstar's Elf Flu got there first, but they were more surface level. It's nice to see such a prevalent social issue make its way into the DC universe. While some may find elements problematic now, I think it's handled deftly, especially for the time. Sean, I agree. Then Scott Arthur chimes in and says, Jim Wilson, the Hulk's early 1970s sidekick, resurfaced in Incredible Hulk number 388 from 1991 with an HIV diagnosis and died 3 years later. But yeah, mainstream comics often skirted around the topic before these stories. Thanks for sharing that, Scott. Appreciate it. Then we heard from Brett Young from the Fire and Water Podcast Network. He does a show called Fantastic Poor, or as the cool kids call it, The Poor. Brett says, great spotlight on the Spectre. I was always conflicted by this character, partly because he doesn't really work in a group dynamic. Can't really see the wrath of God hanging out by the JSA water cooler talking to Jay Garrick about last night's football game. And mostly because he's a supposedly scary dude running around in a Speedo and booties. I always thought that if any DC character was in need of a design update, it was the Spectre. Anyway, I enjoy the conversation, and that's what counts. Tom Mandrake's art is unique, and his pencils are like if Gene Colan was a 90s artist. Lots of mists and flowing movement, but with a heavier line and more imagery packed in. Lots of observations there, Brett. The one I want to take away is, yes, he is absolutely in a Speedo in booties, which is hilarious to think about that he's like a horror-themed guy. So, great point. Then we heard from Dave Tomko from the website called New Earth 2. Dave says, I enjoyed reading the first 12 issues, and I'm going to continue on reading the rest of the series to fill in the blanks. While it was a great read, it does seem dated in some ways, especially how they talk about Amy sleeping with other men before she realized she was HIV positive. But it seems informative about how the topic was treated at the time. That's very fair, Dave. And I do wonder how someone would handle a topic like this today. I honestly don't know. It'd be interesting to see through a 2025 lens how someone might approach the subject. Then Dave goes on to say, I'm going to hit pause on the Spectre and jump into the Batman, Catwoman, Wildcat books before Sunday. Awesome, Dave. I hope you enjoyed the books. I hope you enjoyed Stella and I's feedback on them. Especially the Batman Wildcat one is really exceptional. Then we're from Dave Steele, also from the Earth 2 podcast. Dave says, the Spectre-Freddy Krueger comparison isn't something I'd thought about before. Brilliant! You're totally right, Dave. It's brilliant. And it didn't come from me. It came from my guest, Justin, so he's the one who deserves the props. But yeah. Well, thank you. Then we're from Jose Rivera, author of The Underground Adventures. Jose says, I had some issues of the Spectre as a kid. I think I got them in a $10 grab bag from my local comic shop. I probably wasn't old enough or mature enough for them, as I remember the idea being sealed in a barrel of cement really disturbing to me as a kid. You know, Jose, ironically, I find it really disturbing as an adult as well. So then Jose goes on to say, you know, it's funny, but you don't see the Spectre with the JSA as much these days. I just started listening to this episode on my lunch hour, so maybe it's covered later. But thinking about it, he maybe shows up once in a blue moon with the team, but moves on. The only thing I can think is the writers probably feel he's too powerful and don't know how to write him for a team book. It's like he's a victim of his own success. You're dead on, Jose. I mean, there's no way you can put the wrath of God on the same team with, you know, I don't know, Al Pratt, right? It just doesn't make sense nowadays, the way comic storytelling is done. So, yeah, he may show up in, like, again, the Grant Morrison, JLA issues. He's there for a little bit. But for the most part, Spectre's not going to be hanging out with the JSA on any regular sort of schedule, for sure. Heard from Robert Junker, who asked, is there any more Jesse Quick discussion in the future? Well, Robert, you know, first off, thanks for the kind words. And yes, I always love talking about Jesse Quick, right? There's always space in my heart for more of that discussion. But sadly, we're almost out of her 1990s appearances. However, good news is, once we get to JSA in the 2000s, we'll have a lot more opportunities to talk about Jesse Quick. So I do expect you'll hear a lot more of her in the future. It might just take a little while. Then we're from Nuno Duarte, who says, although I'm a fan of the Ostromandrake duo, I never read a solo Spectre book, and I confess the mystic genre is not my cup of tea. Yet I found the crime and supernatural combo really interesting and narratively well told. Thanks for the recommendation and entertaining insight as always. Oh, well, thank you, Nuno, and I'm glad you found something to enjoy in those comics, and thank you for listening. Then we're from Barry Reese, author of numerous novels, and he runs the Infinity Inc. Tumblr. Barry says, another great episode. I was a huge fan of the Doug Mensch series that preceded Ostringer 1, and I took me a while to give Ostringer version a try because I was feeling really annoyed they had canceled the Mensch's title. Well, there we go. There's Barry. He is a fan of the Doug Mensch series of Spectre, so that's great to hear, Barry. If you want, I'd love to hear what you specifically loved about the series. Maybe not like story beat by story beat, but like what was it about the series that grabbed your attention? Then John Stibe helped promote our show, and he says, one of the best series published in the 1990s was The Spectre by John Ostringer and Tom Mandrake. Check out this glow-in-the-dark spotlight on The Ghostly Guardian by Shag and Justin if you dare. Thank you, John. I always appreciate your efforts to help promote the show. Then we heard from Rockford J, who says, I got an original art page from the Ostringer Mandrake run. Probably my favorite book ever. ever. I've got the whole run, and I even had a letter printed. Wow, Jay, that's fantastic. That's so cool. All right, folks, now this is the part of the show where I am going to thank everyone who shared our show on their social media timeline, Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, and Threads. It's a long list of names. I get that. However, these folks showed their support and helped promote the show. So it's important to me that we recognize these individuals. I mean, this is the only time I'm going to mention Brian Schufo, but you know what? He helped promote the show, so he is part of our family and deserves to be recognized. So this time out, we've got over 80 different people who help promote the show. So you could be on this list next month. It's just as easy by sharing or retweeting or reskeeting, I don't know, whatever the heck it's called, on all the different platforms for Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, and Threads. So our thanks go out too. Well, this first one's actually rather interesting. Some gentleman by the name of Tom Mandrake helped share the show on his social media. So thanks, Tom. Appreciate that. Also, thanks go out to A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, Al Girding, Al Williams, Alan Boyce Jr., Barry Reese's Infinity Ink Tumblr, Between the Pages blog, Bill Beer and his The Bat Pod account, Brad Dade, Brian Schufo, Chris Franklin, Chris Helgerson, Chris Maka, Codex Omniversa, Craig Mack, Ciro Ricardo Moraz, D. Kennedy at Detective 38, Dan Dougherty, Dave Tomko in the New Earth 2 account, Dave's Comic Heroes blog, David Ace Gutierrez, Derek Crabb and his History of Comics on Film account, Diablo Frank, Dr. Ange, Eddie Schmitz, Elaine Wall, Gentleman Joey, Gus Casals, J. David Weider, John Stibe, J.P. Roca, Justin from the Fanholes podcast, Justin Steiner, Keechee Baker, Kid Spectre, Lizanne Oswald, Marcus Arroyce, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Maurice Kane, Michael Kramer, Michael Shane, Mo Walker, Movie Matt Sarois, Nuno Duarte, Otaku Mike, Paul Kian and his DC Specialcast account, Paul Hicks, Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, Pete Flower, Rob Kelly, Robert Junker, S. Matthew Stolte, Samson Truth Vigilante, Scott X, Siskoid, Slangword Scott, Stacy HD, Steve Gibbons and his JLA Stories and Friends account, Stone Free, Stop, Let's Team Up, Symbol Pending, The Earth 2 podcast, and Dave Steele. The Telltale Mind, Tim Bennett, Tim Price and his Outcasters, a Batman and the Outsiders podcast, Tom Goins, Trent Lewis, Uncle Bruno's Customs, Venkman, Willie Arborough and his Black Vulcan 69 account, Zeb Oswald, and Zek Cap Boots. Whew! Folks, thank you so much for your support of the JSA in the 90s podcast. Your feedback is such a critical part of the show, and the community of JSA fans we're building together is absolutely fantastic. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It's probably the fault of Justin from the last episode. I do my best to find all the social media comments, but sometimes they do slip through my internet fingers. So please keep those cards and letters coming. You can go to our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JSA. That is the best place to leave your comments on the show post, and other fellow JSA fans can share their thoughts, and you guys can communicate together. You can also find us on most social media platforms as JSA Presents, again, on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter, or X in Threads, or you can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. My thanks again to you listeners for such a great collection of feedback. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll connect with this episode's guest, Stella, and see if she managed to clean up after Wildcat's battles.
In 1985, Who's Who, the definitive directory of the DC Universe, combined a new piece of art with a text entry to create a brisk monthly comic book format encyclopedia covering the characters and concepts of the world that Superman built. The last volume of Who's Who was released in 1992, right around the time I began to make DC Comics my publisher of choice. I'm Diablo Frank. I'll be recruiting a cadre of expert secret agents to take up the gauntlet thrown down by Who's Who on its 40th anniversary via its successor volumes, The DC Secret Files and Origins. This show intends to spend its first year looking backward to the very beginning of the DC Universe until we turn back around to work our way, month by month, toward the Chromium Age DC Secret Files, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe, 1993 through 2011. Be there for the premiere on April 2nd, launching as part of the JS April 2025 multimedia crossover event. Available on the All Ages 4-color Rolled Spine feed.
Sawate. My name is Stella, and I am the host of Backroll to Oracle, the Barbara Gordon podcast. Backroll to Oracle is a podcast dedicated to Barbara Gordon, the first woman to hold the mantle of Backroll for an extended period of time, roughly 1967 to 1988. The goal of Backroll to Oracle is to examine the character's history from her first appearance as Backroll and continuing through her tenure as Oracle. Each episode looks at a vintage issue of Detective Comics or Batman, as well as other books like Justice League and Freedom Fighters, and modern issues of Batgirl and Birds of Prey. I also keep track of news involving Batgirl and other members of the Bat family, and I have a revolving series of segments like Babs in the Tube, which highlights appearances of Babs in TV and film, Shipper Spotlight, which looks at a variety of comic and pop culture couples, gives their history, and determines whether they are hot or not, Reading with Stella, which could be described as an audio drama, or just me reading a book that relates to Babs or doesn't, and of course, the mainstay literature recommendation. I have been blessed to interview writers Scott Beatty and Chuck Dixon on their Batgirl Year One work, Brian Q. Miller on his Batgirl run, Dwayne Swierczynski and Christy Marks on their separate Birds of Prey work, and the creators and actors of the Batgirl Spoiled, the web series. I hope to interview more creators and actors in the future. My goal, most importantly, is to make a fun, entertaining, and thoughtful show that people enjoy and from which they learn. Find the show online at thebatmanuniverse.net and iTunes, and follow the show on Facebook and Twitter at Batgirl to Oracle. Thank you, and fly on, Babs lovers.
Okay, folks, we're back from break, and yes, we've got Stella back with us. Stella, thank you so much for volunteering to talk about your Zaddy, Wildcat, and appearing on this episode of the show. I sincerely appreciate it. Now, why don't you tell the listeners where they can find you on the internets?
Yeah, thank you so much for letting me come on to talk about Ted. And yeah, if anyone wants to send any sort of artwork to me with Ted, I could be with him in a compromising position. It's up to you. I'm just kidding. Okay. So first, I've got Batgirl the Oracle, the Barbara Gordon podcast, which is on the batmanuniverse.net, where I'm following Barbara Gordon's career. And then over at the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, I'm with Tom on Required Reading with Tom and Stella, where we look at a piece of literature each episode and talk about it. And then here on the Fire and Water Network, podcast network, I do Dear Reader, which is a seasonal show where I take a work of literature and examine it pretty closely. And then the rest of the season, look at adaptations. And this season, as of this recording, I have 3 episodes left that I'm doing. And I'm looking at Homer's epic, The Iliad.
Now, what'd you do for the first 2 seasons, just so they know?
Yes. Season 1 was Jane Eyre, which is my favorite book. And season 2 is a play from the 1930s called The Women.
Such a great show, and just elevates the intellectual level of our network. It goes from Shag saying she's hot to Stella talking about grand literature from centuries ago. So it works great.
There you go. Yep. Comics are confusing right now, I think, and they often go back to the well a bit too much, in my opinion. And I think that this show is great and that you are recapturing some of these great moments for some of these characters. And hopefully it's also a way for people to find out about these. Like, I hope that people become as passionate about Wildcat that you and I are, and they look up more about him. So I'm just super excited that I got to talk about him.
Aw, and I'm super excited that you got to talk about him as well. And folks, I hope you at home get as excited about Wildcat as we are. I expect every comment on this show to include the word Zaddy, Z-A-D-D-Y.
And see, let's pause right now, because now we need to decide, because I was calling him Daddy and you keep calling him Zaddy.
That was what you wrote. That's what you wrote in our messages back and forth.
I think maybe I had a slash. Well, so here's the difference. And then we need to decide, and then also let the people decide.
Oh,
so
is that
a daddy.
There's a term? Oh, I didn't even know this was a thing. Okay.
Yeah, a daddy is it traditionally refers to an older male figure, often with protective or dominant traits. And it can also imply a sexualized item for a male authority figure or idol. Okay. A zaddy describes a man who is not only attractive, but also exudes confidence and charm. It implies a fashionable and sophisticated demeanor, setting it apart from the more traditional daddy. So do you feel like he's a zaddy? Daddy or daddy after that?
Interesting. Well, he's not like a suave, James Bond kind of guy, but there's something about him though. So I don't know. I mean, I'm clearly a zaddy. That's without
okay.
a doubt.
Oh,
but
interesting.
Ted, I'm not sure. He is more of a bruiser type. Okay. All right. Fair enough.
So I lean more towards daddy in that case. And maybe Bruce Wayne is a zaddy.
Oh, that's fair. Okay. This is how uneducated I am. These terms. I had no idea.
Okay, I'm here to educate the boomers.
I'm not a boomer, retard.
I'm just kidding.
It's not my fault you're Gen whatever beta or whatever gen you are, you little kid.
Yeah. Z, I think. I don't know.
She's a little kid, folks. She's
Gen
a little
X,
kid.
I think.
Oh, whatever.
Yeah, I just turned 17.
That's right. There we go. Well, Stella, thank you again so much for doing this. It's always a blast chatting with you. We've been friends a long time, and I'm thrilled we had this opportunity. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, that is going to do it, folks. Now come back next episode when we are back to regular coverage with Justice Society of America number 9. And I'll be joined by a fantastic guest to help me cover the issue. Who will it be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Stella.
And we're asking you to join the fight.
For justice.